The crimes, the criminals, why did they do it? Who got hurt? Did they meet justice or commit the perfect crime? You'll find all the clues at Jim Harold's Crime Scene. Welcome to The Crime Scene. I am Jim Harold, and so glad to be with you once again. And we have what I think will be a fantastic show for you. We're going to talk about one of the most infamous crimes and one of the most supposedly infamous criminals, although I think our guest would beg to differ. We're going to talk about Lizzie Borden. And our guest tonight is Christine Smith. She's been working as a creative advisor and consultant for individuals and businesses for the past several years. She was formerly a professional writer for magazines and newspapers, and now she writes only for her pleasure, sharing her thoughts and ideas on her blog. Now, she has come up with a thesis called Lizzie Borden Exonerated, in which she says she can refute every piece of evidence frequently cited as proof of Lizzie Borden's guilt. And we're so glad to have her with us today. Christine Smith, thank you for joining us and can't wait to get into this.
I'm very pleased to be with you tonight, Jim.
Now, I know you're a listener to the program, so I'd like to thank you, and a supporter of the programs. I'd like to thank you for this, but this topic is fascinating to me. One of those crimes that goes along with things like Jack the Ripper, just something you've heard about since you were a little kid, and you just assume the person is guilty. So I guess probably the easiest place to start is to ask you, what got you into the subject of Lizzie Borden?
Well, as you just said, I too grew up always hearing about Lizzie Borden, even though it happened some 122 years ago, the murders. We're still seeing it today in films and plays and songs and books and movies everywhere we turn. And so, of course, I had always heard of it. And, Jim, I have always had a very deep interest in true crime, particularly because of my study in law and criminal psychology, and I am fascinated by criminal psychopathology and certainly unsolved crimes as well. I've normally tended to focus upon those who were known to be the criminals and how they became that way, the formation of the psychopath. Various topics such as that have always fascinated me. However, I would say the reason I decided to actually do this research was I saw something once again making a reference to Lizzie Borden and vilifying her, of course, as the woman who got away with murder, the woman who killed her parents. Those are the kind of things we've always heard. And I saw another such reference, and I thought to myself, I wonder about this. I should research this myself. I should study it. I certainly have heard all of the rumors and the legends and the assumptions that are often put forward, but I wanted to do my own investigation. And once I did my investigation, there was no way that I could not write my thesis. I was inspired to write this thesis because after my thorough research, I became convinced of Lizzie Borden's innocence, not just, of course, her acquittal being found not guilty in the eyes of the law, which, of course, I agree with when you examine the case, however, that she was innocent. And once I came to that conclusion, I wanted to do as much as I could to exonerate her in the public eye because it really disturbs me to see someone mistreated in life or in death, and they continue to besmirch her name with these false assumptions. And if anyone who was rational and objective did the kind of study that I have done, I believe they would come to the same conclusion. Or, at the very least, if they did not choose to believe, as I do, of her innocence, they certainly would be objective enough to know, to say, I do not know. They would not assume her guilt, as the majority of people I found do.
Now, there was a rhyme, folk rhyme. Lizzie Borden took an axe and gave her mother 40 whacks. And when she saw what she'd done, she gave her father 41. So I know that's kind of the crime encapsulated, but give us exactly, maybe we weren't paying attention in history, exactly what was Lizzie Borden accused of doing and what were the circumstances around the murders?
Certainly, where she was accused of the murder of her father and her stepmother. And the crime took place in Fall River, Massachusetts, August 4th, 1892. The scene of the crime I will briefly describe. Lizzie Borden enters the doorway, coming outside from the barn, comes into the sitting room of her home and finds her father bludgeoned to death lying upon the sofa. He was obviously napping as she had earlier left him, and someone had bludgeoned with a hatchet his head numerous times to the point of mutilation. One of his eyeballs was hanging out and was cut. It was later determined that he had suffered approximately 11 hatchet wounds to the face, destroying the face. In regards to her stepmother, whose body was found upstairs in the guest bedroom, Abby Borden, who was 65, and also her father was age 70 at his death. Her stepmother was found also with hatchet blows to her head, and was approximately 19 hatchet blows to her head. The photographs of these bodies are readily available upon the internet, Jim, for those who are interested in regarding crime scene photographs of it. So she stood accused of this, the murder of her father and her stepmother. She was arrested about 8 days after the murders. At the crime scene, the house that day was only occupied by Lizzie, who at this time was 32 years old, and also their Irish immigrant maid, Bridget Sullivan. She's estimated to be in her mid-20s, probably around 26. They were the only two individuals inside of the house that day. And as I said, Lizzie was arrested about 8 days later. She would, if she had been found guilty at the trial, which was held about 10 months later, she would have suffered execution, death by hanging.
That seems like, I think that, and I'm certainly not an expert, experts call it overkill. Like, whoever killed these people really were very motivated, because overkill is the idea, instead of shooting somebody one time, you shoot them 20 times. Same thing here. It seems like overkill was involved. So it would almost seem like a crime of passion, not passion in the romantic sense, but passion in terms of great disagreement or great anger.
Yes, what it indicates from my study of crime scenes and criminals is suppressed rage. Psychologically, the crime scene itself, as many people know, can tell us a lot. And this is characteristic of suppressed anger. This type of violence that was exhibited upon the faces of the victims does not indicate any conflict of feelings. For example, in crimes in which someone kills a relative or a loved one or a partner, there is often the conflict is shown because of the nature of the way that the murder takes place, sometimes the covering of the body. Certainly, we don't usually see mutilation of the faces, which is usually we do equate with much suppressed rage. That is the one thing we know about motive, that this was suppressed rage. And it is also characteristic, I would say, in my study of serial killers, although that is not what we're discussing here, but it perhaps may be relevant as well. There is what we call the disorganized killer. And this is someone who does a murder on impulse. They are often of low social order, and they do an act of sudden violence. And some of the characteristics actually reminded me of that. And I wondered if it also pertains psychologically to this. Certainly the suppressed anger suggests that to me.
So why, you know, she got off, as some people would say, but why does everybody, first of all, how did she, you know, how was she found not guilty? And then, why does she continue to get this bad rap? So how did she become not guilty? What were the circumstances? And why does she continue to have the bad rap despite that?
Well, first of all, I'm going to direct me to that first question in a moment. I'd like to answer the second part of that. She continues to get that bad rap, as you said, because the majority of people, when they grow up with something everyone is saying, it's this herd mentality idea, and everybody just accepts it without any critical, objective thought. And once they've heard music, once they've seen films, they just accept something which either could have been speculative fiction or perhaps legend. Whatever they might be seeing, they accept it as fact. Most people do not engage in critical thought. Most people are not rational or logical. And when they hear a rhyme, such as you shared and everybody has heard, they accept it as fact rather than, like myself, deciding to investigate it themselves, or at least, even if they didn't care to do an investigation such as I, withhold judgment. As to your first question in regards to the trial, she was acquitted. It was approximately a 13-day trial. The jury deliberated for about an hour and a half, and I must say, from my study of law, it most certainly was the correct decision by the jury by law, but of course an acquittal does not for innocence make. That is why I decided to actually investigate it and research this myself. In regards to the trial, I would have to say, in my opinion, there was absolutely no reason except a legal decision with which I disagree based upon my objective looking for the indictment to have even occurred. There is not any evidence that I find credible. And as you began this interview with me, all, quote, evidence, end quote, that is frequently cited is oftentimes, I must say, you dismiss it with rationality. Some of it you just have to see is pure opinions and suppositions. There really was nothing to go on. Some of the things that the prosecution did want to admit was determined to be inadmissible, prejudicial. Upon examination of those, I would agree. And her inquest testimony, interestingly enough, was not allowed to be entered into the trial, which I think was probably what they really wanted to rely upon. Ironically, however, it is her inquest testimony, Jim, that I found quite credible and articulate and consistent. So it was a decision and with which I would disagree for it to even have been brought to trial. But the trial itself actually is a great help to those such as myself who wish to investigate it, because it convinced me of her innocence for several reasons.
What things did the prosecution point to that you think are erroneous, some of the specifics?
Frequently, I would say the prosecution, they were not able to admit this, but most people familiar with the case would think of it. There was a claim that Lizzie Borden had attempted to purchase a poison called prussic acid the day before at a pharmacy. We have no reason to believe that this is so, despite, quote, eyewitnesses. And I put that in quote marks because their testimony itself is just not credible to me. And I would quickly let your listeners know this because it's one of the number one evidences that they claim. The man in question, Eli Bentz, had actually spoken to a neighbor, Jim, and told him he couldn't identify the woman. It was someone that he did not know, and he just had no recognition. However, he did think perhaps if he saw her again, he might recognize her. Contrast this and what was done with today and how we would do an identification.
Sure.
They actually brought this man to Lizzie Borden's home a few hours after sunset, to a home with no electricity, stood him in the doorway of her kitchen as she was sitting in a chair, turned him away and said, "Is that her?" And he said, "Yes." And so it was that face-to-face. We already know that eyewitness testimony in itself is one of the ones, due to emotional stress, that is one of the most unreliable. But if you take a person to someone's home, point into another room and say, "Was that her?" We also have two other witnesses who were trying to identify, you know, what woman had attempted to buy this poison, as if it were even relevant, which is, well, it was inadmissible. They considered it prejudicial, even if it had been proven to have happened. And they described the voice as being very different from what this man testified. High-pitched, loud, haughty, arrogant, and another one said very low and demure type of thing. So it's really nothing that one could look at. But they're only saying as if, and prussic acid was something that was used at that time, believe it or not. It's a really fatal, very dangerous, but it was used. I even did research and found various uses it was recommended for. Women frequently tried to buy such things. In my opinion, it was probably another woman who tried to do that. There's also testimony, Jim, regarding the burning of a dress. It's one of the things people most cite. I would put it into the context of this. She was seen burning one of her dresses during the week that she was held in her home before her arrest. Putting it into the context, this is a home that constantly kept a stove burning in order to heat water or to cook. And her sister had recommended, while they were cooped up there for this long period of time, to go through that clothing, get rid of this dress that has paint on it. The defense had witnesses to the fact that she had gotten paint on her dress just previously when there was painting being done outside. Her sister had suggested, "Why don't you at least destroy this?" She did it in front of everybody, completely innocently, as one of the tasks of the day, as she also would be doing laundry.
Now, one thing that I think is interesting about this, and I want to get back to who, if it wasn't Lizzie, who might it if it had been? But attitudes towards women. It's always been my viewpoint that in this particular time in history, that, and we're talking about the late 1800s here, that women were considered better seen, not heard, that women should be quiet, they should not be forceful, they should take a secondary role. If women were prone to, quote, hysteria, that, you know, they might go off the deep end because they are the, quote, weaker sex, according to the misguided folk of the time. That's my perception. Is that a correct perception, and did that play into the prosecution and, you would say, persecution of Lizzie Borden?
I believe it did. At the time, Lizbeth was, and I would like to refer to her as Lizbeth. At this point, I'd like to share with your listeners, out of respect for this woman, that she went by the name Lizbeth. Everyone knows her as Lizzie Borden, but the majority of her adult life, she was known by Lizbeth, by her friends, by everyone. So I'm going to call her Lizbeth from this point out. Lizbeth was a very intelligent, by all accounts, very intelligent, very compassionate, very gentle woman. She was also somebody who, I would say, was able to stay calm in the midst, and this pertains to what you are asking, in the midst of the incredible duress and stress that she was under, not only being charged with the murder of her father, whom she loved dearly, and her stepmother, but also it came at a time during her inquest testimony, since this is just a few days I am referring to, that she remained calm. I remember that her pastor called it the calmness of innocence that we always saw, and I believe that after studying the kind of lady that she was. She did not react emotionally, or I would say with emotionalism, despite the hounding. It's terrible to see how she was questioned at the inquest, and that in itself is a reflection upon the prosecutor, in my opinion, because it was a hounding meant to break a woman, to make her respond, to shock her, to get her upset. And instead, we find a woman who rationally and logically and consistently answered his questions. It seemed to me, reading the transcripts, as if it very much frustrated him. And in that hounding, he was not able to provoke her. We did see evidence of very deep emotion in Lizbeth, especially during the trial. Also, those friends who knew her and visited her during those 10 months while she was incarcerated awaiting trial. And I would say one of the main points at the time that put their suspicion onto Lizbeth was the fact that she referred to her stepmother as her stepmother. And when anyone referred to her as your mother, she would correct them very objectively, without any hostility, but only with cordiality. That is my stepmother, not my mother. That, at the time, from what I understand, really disturbed the men, because that wasn't the normal, quote, normal behavior of a woman. And even today, Jim, we see this. At someone's death, everyone is supposed to feign love for the deceased.
Yes.
Whether they had the love, or they may not have had the love, but they go into this. She did not do that. She remained objective. She was, at the time of the murders, spoke of both her father and her stepmother, identical to how she spoke of them before. The men at the time, it appears, could not accept that and found that highly suspicious that you would correct someone and say it's your stepmother. I find that just incredulous that they would think that much, as if it suggests a murderer, just because you correct them objectively.
So, and again, have to be fair to the other people in this case, not just Ms. Borden. But if not her, who are some of the people who it could have been? Or do you have a firm theory as to who it was?
No, I do not, but I would tell you what I found suspicious. The time for evidence gathering was then, rather than having an overzealous prosecution and suspicion immediately placed upon the daughter. I would say that objectivity would have called for an objective look and investigation into the maid, the other individual who was there. Certainly, there have been theories suggested about other people, an intruder. Frankly, I find that unlikely only due to the size of the house, the time frame over 2 hours between the two murders, one being upstairs, one being downstairs, that would necessitate an intruder having hidden in the home, which does seem unlikely with two women in the home, but anything is possible. What I do find very disturbing, I do not know who committed this murder. We probably, obviously, never will. But had I been an investigator at the time or a prosecution at the time, I certainly would have equally investigated the maid, whom I did find several things that certainly made me wonder. Number one, she had equal opportunity. Speaking of motive, as we did earlier a bit and touched upon that, the maid was dismissed from any suspicion, Jim, simply because she was a maid. Interestingly enough, and perhaps some of your listeners, being listeners and students of true crime, might remember that historically speaking, as well as to the present day, we have numerous murders when you take a look at murdering maids. Some of the most heinous crimes of mutilation, including mutilation of the faces of employers done by maids. But at the time of this, for some reason, they simply dismissed the maid for investigation or suspicion, as if she might be a suspect because she was a maid. Thus, she was able to leave the house of the murders that night, gather some of her things and leave, come back the next morning, Jim, make another bundle, and leave the house never to return. I would also add that, unfortunately, we do not have the inquest testimony, the only lost inquest testimony of everyone who was questioned at the time. The inquest testimony of Bridget Sullivan, the maid, was lost, so we cannot compare what her original answers to the prosecutor were versus what she said at the trial. And I would also share with you, her trial testimony itself was very suspicious to me. Because it was so extremely detailed, Jim. If I were to ask you, Jim, what you did 4 days ago on a specific day, and I wanted you to tell me down to every detail, the exact order, what you did, you wouldn't be able to do it. You would be able to give me generalities. You would be able to give me truthfully what you did, but not as precisely as her testimony before the prosecutor, for the prosecutor, comes out in extreme detail, which is contrary. It when she is questioned by the defense, she suddenly goes into, I don't know and I don't remember. And one of the most glaring things that did make me suspicious of her was the fact that she maintained with the prosecution in the trial. She also met with the prosecutor the day before, Jim, and was seen handing a note back and forth. It strongly suggests a rehearsal. Thus, she had detailed testimony for him, but on cross-examination went into, I don't know. I read the transcript of a neighbor who said that the maid actually told her that there was a note, speaking of evidences used against Elizabeth frequently, that the maid had told this neighbor that a note had arrived and Abby Borden had stopped her dusting and hurried off. That was the testimony of Adelaide Churchill, a neighbor. Contrast that with the maid's testimony with the prosecutor. She had no knowledge of such a note till she heard Lizzie Borden mention it to her father. The note, Jim, is frequently used because they could not find a note, as if that's supposed to be evidence of her guilt. It appears to me there was certainly a note, of which Elizabeth Borden simply said, a note arrived by messenger calling her stepmother to help a sick friend, versus the maid saying, I knew nothing of a note, with the prosecutor in trial, but we also have testimony that she told someone that she saw Abby Borden leave. And of course, we know Abby Borden didn't leave. She was murdered upstairs. I find all of that suspicious, but again, I do not see any evidence worthy of indicting either woman. The time for investigation was then, but I found it really unsettling that they at least did not examine this maid simply because she was a maid.
There was one theory I saw, and sometimes you never know what you'll see on the internet, but I saw a theory that some people speculate that perhaps Borden and the maid Elizabeth Borden and the maid had a romantic relationship and they were caught in the act. Has that come across as a theory that you've run into? Do you think there's any kind of plausibility to that whatsoever?
I see no merit to it. I have seen that one, as I have seen many others, Jim, that are rumor and are gossip. There is absolutely no evidence to suggest that whatsoever, and it is more a reflection upon the heart and mind of those who would choose to accept such a theory when there is no evidence to merit even that being said. It is just as well to concoct any story you want to explain this, because there is nothing to support such a thing. It really, as I said, is a reflection upon the values of the people who would choose to engage in such gossip.
And another little interesting factoid I came across in my research, I don't know if you've heard this, and it's just kind of interesting. There was a famous TV movie in the 70s with Elizabeth Montgomery. You know her from Bewitched, a really fine actress. And turns out she played in this movie, and then someone did the research. Turned out that she was a sixth cousin once removed from Lizzie Borden. I thought that was amazing.
I ran across that too. I think it was, I remember the actress herself found that very interesting.
Yeah, that is funny. And the funny thing is, when I first saw the picture of Elizabeth Borden, I said, she does look a little bit about Elizabeth Montgomery. And then I read down and I saw that. So that was kind of cool. So what happened to Elizabeth Borden after this? After she escaped conviction, and I don't mean that in a bad way. I just mean that she wasn't convicted. What was the rest of her life like?
After the acquittal, Jim, she went on to live a life consistent with the life she had lived prior to that in regards to her character. She had always been known as a very gentle woman, a very compassionate lady, and she had been deeply involved in charitable causes. So after the acquittal, she and her sister moved to a home, which she named Maplecroft, and it was up on the hill, as is referred to. She and her sister lived there together for about 10 years. Her sister always believed in her innocence and expressed that as so. After they parted ways, Elizabeth continued to live in her home there in Fall River, despite the ostracization by her community. While she lived there, she was known to be a lover of the arts. She loved theater. She frequently would make trips to Boston, sometimes to New York. She was very artistically inclined, theatrically, theater, and appreciated that. But as a person, what really impresses me is the continued evidence of the character of this woman. Because at the time, we see a portrait of a woman by how her friends spoke of her. And they did stand behind her, even during the trial, who did not condone violence and was very caring. And after that, her countenance, she gave very generously to friends and associates and servants. She had always been known to help immigrants. But anonymously, and I emphasize that to your listeners, even though the community ostracized her, this is a lady who cared enough to use her monies, her wealth, to help people in need. She anonymously provided college scholarships to those in Fall River. Mm. She anonymously purchased provisions, including food, as well as other provisions to families in need, and simply would order things to be delivered to their doorsteps. As I said, all her life she was known to be very giving, charitable, and gracious. And she was also, I would say, she loved reading prose, poetry, just to give you an idea of her personality as well as her character that was known. And even in death, she was very generous, both to her friends, her associates, and her servants. She actually bequeathed a large portion of her wealth at the time at her death, which was her stock holdings in a manufacturing company, as well as $30,000 to one animal rescue and in Fall River, and also more to another animal rescue in Washington, D.C., which was quite characteristic of her. She did care for people as well as for animal companions. And that kind of money, Jim, in today's dollars, not even counting the stock holdings, would be equivalent to about $500,000. This is in addition to the bequeathing of her properties and other assets to her friends as well as to the hired servants. So again, her entire life was one of generosity and caring. She was known to express herself beautifully in letters and cards. Whether it was a friend or a servant or a stranger, she expressed love to others.
So what lessons do you think that this case has for us? Greater lessons beyond just whether or not one innocent woman has been unfairly vilified throughout the years. What in general can this case say to us?
Well, two things, in general and specific to this case. I wish to exonerate Lizbeth Borden in the public eye, because if one studies it, everything, the inquest testimony and the trial, rather than pointing to anything to be guilty, it points to her innocence. There was really no reason for her to be a suspect beyond being a suspect, as well as the other person should have been equally examined as a suspect. And if you did that, you can find nothing that would lead one to be suspicious of Lizbeth Borden. But the bigger picture here is, use this as an example, when the facts are few, do not let speculation, wild at times, just like the one that you suggested, make you form an opinion of other persons. Whether we are talking about someone accused of a crime, do not assume their guilt. And even if everyone else believes it, make a decision to find out enough for yourself, or else be objective enough to say, I don't know, and withhold your judgment. Because I would have to say rumor and fiction and speculation distort the truth. If you really care about the truth, then it is much wiser to say, I do not know, rather than forming an opinion and continuing to repeat it to other people and laugh about it and make rhymes about it, even in today's day and age with people accused of crimes or even in your own neighborhood. Do not engage in gossip. Wisdom is saying, I don't know, and withholding judgment. And I do not see that very many people care about the truth anymore. They prefer gossip. They prefer rumor. And it is, again, a reflection on their heart instead of being rational enough to withhold judgment of a brother or sister.
Well, it's interesting because all we have to do is look at the headlines today, particularly with things like DNA. And it seems like constantly we're hearing about convicted felons who have been in the penitentiary for 10, 20, 30 years, and they're being exonerated with this new evidence that's out there. So it goes to reason that not only is that happening today, but that's happened from the beginning of time, really.
Yes, it has. And I would like to add that in regard specifically to those who have been convicted of crimes, whatever they might have been, first of all, it takes a very intense study of a trial, not just because someone is found guilty before one should assume that they are guilty. And not everybody needs to do that, and you just can withhold that judgment and just understand someone was found guilty. And of course, in general, the way trials are done today, it might influence your opinion. You might not choose to be involved with that person. But still, withhold that judgment because you do not know. And I would also say, do not judge those who have been convicted of crimes after they have served their time and been released. Some will claim their innocence. They may or may not be. But it is wrong to always hold those who have been convicted of a crime, guilty or innocent, and judge their character to be the same as of that crime, even if they were convicted of it. Judgmentality. We have no right to judge and condemn someone. We only have a right to protect society. And yes, as you said, it is very sad to see those that have been serving many years in life if they haven't already been executed and later being exonerated with the evidence. That should give people pause. I am an opponent of the death penalty. I previously was someone who believed it brought justice. And as I examine my heart and my belief in love, I now know absolutely not. You do not cold-bloodedly, and that's what it is, kill someone in order to provide justice. Justice would be bringing the one who died back to life. That is impossible in our realm, so you merely protect society. The death penalty and capital punishment is evil, and it would certainly would avoid those, as you said, the innocent ones being executed. But beyond that, it is evil to execute someone for killing. And I would just share that because part of my interest in studying this case was because it was a capital case. And once again, I find the accused not only to be not guilty, but in this case, innocent.
It's interesting if you look at this in its granularity and the work you've done on this. So if people are interested in learning more about this famous case and your perspective on it, where can they go?
Certainly, Jim. I invite everyone to my blog, Lizzie Borden Exonerated, which you can find at tiny.cc/Lizzie. Again, that's tiny, T-I-N-Y, dot C-C slash Lizzie, L-I-Z-Z-I-E.
Well, Christine, thank you so much for joining us today. We certainly appreciate it. It is an interesting case. Lizzie Borden Exonerated. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And thank you for tuning into the latest edition of The Crime Scene. We certainly appreciate it. And as always, be careful out there. Bye-bye, everybody.